The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the North Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'll be reading from Volume 58, Number 1, which is called Travel Your State, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. It's their Fall 2018 edition. First article, Wish You Were Here, The Coastal Plain, by George Willoughby, who was a senior at North Carolina State University studying history and journalism. In 2018, he was an intern at the North Carolina Museum of History in Raleigh, where he assisted with the museum's summer camps. The waters off the North Carolina coast are known as the Graveyard of the Atlantic. A claim of up to 5,000 shipwrecks means this nickname is one that is certainly deserved. However, the importance and the history of our coast go much deeper. The same coast that you can visit on your family vacation was also visited hundreds of years ago by European explorers traveling around the world. In 1524, Giovanni de Verrazzano was sailing in search of a route to the Pacific Ocean, but instead found the Cape Fear area of North Carolina and the Pamlico Sound. Sir Walter Raleigh later founded the Roanoke Colony on Roanoke Island in 1585. Though it failed, Sir Walter Raleigh's sponsorship of the Roanoke Colony led to the capital of North Carolina being named after him more than 200 years later. The mysterious disappearance of the lost colony still inspires stories to this day. The Age of Pirates brought out another legend of North Carolina. Pirates ruled North Carolina waters around the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Pirates could use small coastal communities as hideouts, markets for their pirated goods, areas to repair their ships, and a haven to rest from the sea. This period saw the rise of cities like Bath and New Bern. In 1766, New Bern became North Carolina's first permanent capital. The Governor's Palace and gardens at Tryon Palace, along with other historical buildings and the new North Carolina History Center, are all great sights to see in New Bern. Bath was North Carolina's first town, and later the home of Blackbeard, the notorious pirate. In 1718, 300 years ago, Blackbeard ran his ship Queen Anne's Revenge aground on a sandbar near Beaufort. Queen Anne's Revenge is just one of the many ships that came to rest in the Graveyard of the Atlantic. The Civil War, World War I, and World War II all brought action to North Carolina. The coast was vital to Civil War blockade runners, light ships used to get supplies past Union forces. Coming from Wilmington, the blockade runners were successful with the protection of the guns of Fort Fisher. However, not all blockade runners were unscathed. The modern Greece ran aground while speeding away from the USS Cambridge toward Fort Fisher. It ran aground only a half mile away from the fort and was then sunk by the fort's guns to avoid the capture of its cargo. The graveyard has also captured the USS Monitor, the United States' first ironclad ship. Though it was suited for river travel, the USS Monitor was traveling along the coast for action in Wilmington, but ran into storms near Cape Hatteras and sank. In World War I and World War II, German U-boats were very active off of North Carolina's Outer Banks. In World War I, U-boats sank 10 ships in a show of German naval might. But in World War II, the attacks were more frequent and had an intended purpose to cut off the supply line to soldiers in Europe. During this time, the waters off of the Outer Banks became known as Torpedo Junction because of the large number of ships that were being attacked. Though the history of North Carolina's coast sounds dangerous and ominous, it has also led to advancements that are extremely beneficial. Early shipwrecks led to the establishment of many of the iconic lighthouses along the coast. The dangerous seas also led to the creation of the United States Life-Saving Service, which rescued shipwrecked sailors and passengers, and is now the United States Coast Guard. The history of North Carolina's coast has created many wild legends about the stories of the past, the stories of the lost colony, Blackbeard and other pirates, and the naval history of North Carolina are still told today and influence the cultures of North Carolina and the East Coast. If you'd like to learn more about the maritime history of North Carolina, be sure to visit one of our state's regional museums in Hatteras, Beaufort, and Southport. Here are some fast facts. The coastal plain is in the eastern part of the state and has 41 counties. Its largest city is Fayetteville, with a population of 204,759. Its average temperatures are 56 degrees Fahrenheit in winter and 90 degrees Fahrenheit in summer. Its size is 21,000 square miles. A geographical fact, it's often divided into two parts, the outer and inner coastal plains. Its soil is sand and clay, and its dominant feature is wetlands. It's known for farming, beaches, lighthouses, barrier islands, the Dismal Swamp, pirates, shipwrecks, Pepsi Cola, seafood, and barbecue. A weird fact, it's the only place in the world where Venus flytraps grow naturally. And here are the captions that accompany the photographs in this article. Earth, wind, water, and sky come together in beautiful ways at the beach. But dramatic weather has always helped shape our history here. On the morning of October 15, 1954, Hurricane Hazel, one of the most destructive hurricanes in U.S. history, slammed into the North Carolina coast. In 2018, Hurricane Florence rivaled Hazel's impact. A young woman wades through deep water at Carolina Beach following Hazel. Cape Hatteras Lighthouse is a symbol of North Carolina tourism. In 1999, after much public debate, the National Park Service moved the lighthouse to save it from beach erosion and encroaching seas. One of the graveyards of the Atlantic's many shipwrecks is exposed on the beach at Nag's Head. The next article is one of the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine article contest winners. One Small Step for Man, One Giant Leap for Rhodhiss, R-H-O-D-H-I-S-S. It's written by Luke Crawford. As a member of the Seed History Seekers Garner Area Homeschoolers, Renee Wimberly and Jeannie Crawford advisors, Luke Crawford was the winner of the 2018 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine Article Contest, Intermediate Division. On July 20, 1969, astronaut Neil Armstrong on Apollo 11 became the first human to set foot on the moon, and he took a little piece of North Carolina with him. Rhodhiss is a 1,000-person town located about 8 miles northwest of Hickory in the Piedmont region of North Carolina. Rhodhiss is located in two counties in North Carolina, Burke and Caldwell. It is a total of 1.3 square miles, but it managed to make a historical mark on the moon 250,000 miles away. This little town, which was named for John M. Rhodes and George B. Hiss, is credited for manufacturing the durable nylon used to make the 6 U.S. flags for each lunar mission. So how did this tiny town end up with this out-of-the-world honor? Before the moon missions, the supplier of the flags to the United States government was a company called Valley Forge. However, Valley Forge did not make the necessary nylon for the flags. They purchased it from Rhodhiss, and then took the material and dyed it, cut it, and sewed it into a flag at the Valley Forge factory. Several former Rhodhiss workers say they made the flag fabric, and at that time in 1969, Burlington was the world's largest textile company. The lunar flag was woven in a factory named Burlington Mills that was being managed by Glenn Price, who was a lifelong Rhodhiss resident. Roy Wisnant was a former factory worker who explained that the workers did not know that the flag was made of the material that they had assembled until a notice was posted on the company bulletin board for everyone to see. In addition to the lunar flag material, the Burlington Mills factory also made materials for bulletproof vests, space suits, and parachutes. Burlington Mills closed in 1983. It was suggested by designers that a full-size special flag and a specially designed flagpole would be used to make America's mark on the moon. It took a few days for Division Chief Dave McCraw to assemble the special flagpole. Because the atmosphere of the moon is entirely different from the atmosphere of Earth, engineers had to build a special flagpole to create the illusion that the flag was flying in the breeze, when, in fact, the moon has no breeze. There were also special considerations for the weight of the flag as well as the case and assembling it because the astronauts would be putting the flag and flagpole together while wearing astronaut gloves. In the end, the flag was 3 feet tall and 5 feet wide. The materials for the flag cost $5.50. The cost for making the flagpole was $75. All this planning and designing was done in Rodhis. Before 1969, there was no official town seal. However, after the flag landed on the moon, Rodhis created its official city seal that shows an astronaut planting the American flag. As visitors enter the town, they see a sign that welcomes them and states, "United States moon flags woven here." Sadly, the flag from Apollo 11 blew away during the liftoff from the moon's surface. In 2014, Art Delaney, the new town manager, decided to apply for a historical marker from the state. However, when the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources responded to refuse the request, officials stated that the story couldn't be proved. However, the people of Rodhis believe in their hearts that their little town made a big impact in the history of the state, the nation, and the world. This changed North Carolina history forever by showing that little towns can do big things. Next, an author interview with Robert Beatty. Robert Beatty is the author of the number one New York Times bestselling Serafina series and the new book, Willa of the Wood, all published by Disney Hyperion. He lives in Asheville with his wife and three daughters. We interviewed Beatty about his books, which are all set in North Carolina. I've read that you have three daughters and that your books have become a family project. Did your daughters inspire you to write? How are they involved in the family business? I'm the father of three girls, so I enjoy writing stories for them and with them about brave and unusual girls with heroic hearts. In the Serafina book series and in my new book, Willa of the Wood, my heroines are strong, highly capable girls who are striving to find themselves and their place in the world. When I'm writing, my practice is to read completed chapters aloud to the girls when they get home from school for the day. They give me instant feedback, and that helps me refine the story. What inspired you to set your story in a well-known historical place like Biltmore Estate, rather than invent your own fictional setting? My family and I live very close to Biltmore, and we visit there often. It's a place filled with history, beauty, and a sense of mystery. We love exploring its rooms and corridors and envisioning all the stories, both realistic and imaginative, that could take place there. Did you get a lot of historical research while working on your books? Did you do a lot of research? Even though my books are works of fiction, it is very important to me that I portray the setting, time period, historical details, and language as accurately as possible. To make sure I'm getting it all right, I do quite a bit of research, and I consult with linguists, historians, folklorists, and naturalists familiar with the region of Western North Carolina toward the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. Of course, I also use my imagination and some creative license where I need to for the sake of the story. Did you like history when you were growing up? What kinds of books did you like to read? I've always loved medieval fantasy stories and authors like J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. The Book of Merlin and The Once and Future King by T.H. White were some of my favorites when I was a child. Over the years, I've enjoyed reading Jane Austen, Ernest Hemingway, and Charles Dickens, and the spooky and strange short stories of Edgar Allan Poe. How long have you been writing? Did you like writing when you were a kid? Was there anyone special, a parent or a teacher, who encouraged you to write? When I was 11 years old, my mother gave me a typewriter to occupy my time because I'd read all the books in the house. I started using the typewriter to write my own novels, and I've been writing ever since. 40 years after writing those first stories as a young boy, I had my first published novel, Serafina and the Black Cloak. As I was writing through all those years, my main goal was to keep at it, to continue improving my craft and learning how to tell a story a little bit better. Do you have a special place for writing, or can you write anywhere? When I need to focus on my writing, I retreat from my office in the house, where life with three busy girls and a menagerie of pets can get hectic, and move to a workspace in our barn. It's a quiet, sunny spot on the second floor with views of gardens and fields and the river bottom beyond. From the windows, I can watch the birds soar overhead and wildlife emerge from the tree line in the evenings. When I need a break, I can walk down to the first floor workshop where my daughters and I build robots and tinker a while. I've written all of my books, Serafina and the Black Cloak, Serafina and the Twisted Staff, Serafina and the Splintered Heart, and Willa of the Wood in this special spot. Tell us a little about the first book in your new series, Willa of the Wood, published July 2018, that's set in the Great Smoky Mountains. Is the Willa book similar to the Serafina books or completely different? My family and I live in western North Carolina near the Great Smoky Mountains. The mountains in this area provide a place of amazing diversity in plant and animal life, majestic forests, a rich and fascinating cultural history, and breathtaking rugged beauty. In Willa of the Wood, I wanted to tell the story of a forest girl who has such a close, empathic relationship with the natural world that she fears and has trouble understanding humans who don't. While Willa is set during the same time, 1900, as Serafina, the book depicts a very different way of life, that of the forests, the natives who lived there for generations, and the newcomers and changes they brought, all of which are part of the historical and cultural fabric of the Great Smoky Mountains. What's next? Will we see more books about Serafina and Willa, or do you have something completely new in the works? Yes, there are more adventures to come for Serafina and Willa. I'm currently researching and writing the fourth book in the Serafina series, set for release in 2019. After that, I'll be working on a second Willa book coming sometime in 2020. Here's a word from the author. My new book, Willa of the Wood, is set in and inspired by the Great Smoky Mountains, a place of amazing diversity in plant and animal life, majestic old-growth forests, a rich and fascinating cultural history, and breathtaking rugged beauty. Last summer, my oldest daughter, Camille, and I explored the Smokies together, delving into the heart of Willa's world. We walked among trees and climbed over river rocks, studied ferns and wildflowers, watched salamanders slither and slide, and deer graze in the morning sun, and visited some of the area's original homestead cabins. I wrote many of the most important lines of Willa's story sitting behind a beside a mountain stream while Camille took photographs of the magical world around us. Here's the Think About It sidebar. Those of us who love history also love reading books about history and stories set in the past. But what is the difference between history and historical fiction? History is nonfiction writing, usually written by historians, and tells us true historical facts. Historical fiction is a creative story or novel whose plot takes place in a setting located in the past. The events or background can be true, and some characters might be based on real people, but as with all fiction, some of the story is based on the author's imagination. When you read something, how can you tell if it's history or historical fiction? What can you do to test whether the history in a story is true or not? And here are the captions with the accompanying photographs. Author Robert Beatty reviews footage from the Serafina book trailer while on the set with his youngest daughter, Elizabeth. Visit his website at robert-beatty.com. A still image from the book trailer that Beatty and his family filmed for Serafina and the Black Cloak at Biltmore Estate, which you can see in the background. His daughter, Genevieve, in the red dress, played Serafina. Author Robert Beatty and his family made several book trailers that you can see on his website. Daughter Camille portrayed Lady Rowena in the trailer for Serafina and the Twisted Staff. Author Robert Beatty says, exploring the Great Smoky Mountains with my oldest daughter, Camille, was one of the inspirations for my new book, Willa of the Wood. Camille is an avid photographer and nature lover. Many of her traits and ideas inspired similar traits and ideas in Willa. The next article is Starring North Carolina, Making Movies Across the Three Regions. It's written by Laura Boys, who has been North Carolina Museum of Art film curator for 18 years and programs the Movie Diva film series at the Carolina Theater of Durham. She's a longtime member of the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival Selection Committee and a regular contributor to Movies on the Radio, a monthly segment on WUNC Radio's The State of Things program. Her website is www.moviediva.com. Want to know another way to explore the three regions of North Carolina? Go to the movies. What do you think of when you think of movies? The glamour of Hollywood. That's what most people might think. But California is not the only state to have a vibrant film culture. Films have been shot in our home state for more than 100 years. The most famous early North Carolina film is Silent. There's no dialogue, only music. Stark Love, from 1927, was directed by cinematographer Carl Brown. Brown became obsessed with a book he stumbled upon in an Asheville bookstore, Our Southern Highlanders, published in 1913, about the isolation of Appalachian mountain communities. Brown went to Graham County near Big Santitla Creek, which had been cleared for a dam project, to create his fantasy Appalachian community. He wanted the background faces on the screen to be authentic mountain folk and rented the locals' old log cabins, spinning wheels, and quilts for atmosphere. You can watch it on YouTube and enjoy a fictionalized glimpse into 19th century North Carolina. Archivist Frank Thompson has devoted himself to chronicling the 400 silent films shot in North Carolina, even though he's only been able to locate 12. Many films of the silent era from 1895 to 1927 have been lost to decay and neglect. Very few sound films, or talkies as they were first called, used North Carolina locations until the 1970s, since the studios preferred a Los Angeles home base. Even movies that were set in our state, like Bright Leaf, 1950, about the founding of American Tobacco, or Ruby Gentry, 1952, about a poor Carolina gal hopelessly in love with a rich boy, were actually filmed in California. Biltmore Estate in Asheville has been used to represent wealth and privilege in many films over the years. It represents a castle belonging to European royalty in The Swan, 1956, the last film Grace Kelly made before becoming the real-life Princess Grace of Monaco. In Being There, in 1979, Biltmore House is transported on film to Washington, D.C. as the mansion of a wealthy businessman. In Richie Rich, in 1994, based on the familiar comic book character, it is the home of the world's richest boy, played by Home Alone's Macaulay Culkin. The North Carolina Film Commission was founded in 1980 by Governor James B. Hunt. He saw an opportunity to bring film production on a large scale to the state. Producer Dino De Laurentiis, who made his name bringing Italian-language films to the United States, built Screen Gems Studio in Wilmington, and full-scale Hollywood-style production arrived. His first major film was Firestarter in 1984, which used Orton Plantation and the streets of Wilmington as locations. It stars Drew Barrymore, who 2 years before had become well-known for her role in the ever-popular E.T. the Extraterrestrial, 1982. Here are just a few of the many films that used North Carolina locations. The Color Purple, 1985, directed by Steven Spielberg, based on a novel by Alice Walker. It was filmed in locations all over the state, including Marshville, Newhall, Ansonville, Wadesboro, Lylesville, and Salisbury. Dirty Dancing, 1987, was filmed at Lake Lure, the Grove Park Inn, and in Asheville. And The Last of the Mohicans, 1992, with Daniel Day-Lewis, was shot in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Chimney Rock, Linville Falls, Pisgah National Forest, and other western mountain locations. One of my favorite North Carolina films is Bull Durham, 1988. Aside from a scene in Mitch's Tavern in Raleigh, this movie was all filmed within a mile of where I live in Durham. I was even an extra in one ballpark scene, watching actor Kevin Costner catch pop fly balls. The movie Snorting Bull was created by the film's art department for scenes shot at the stadium, and they left it as a gift to the real-life team. Now, of course, it is a beloved part of Durham Bulls lore. Maybe you saw The Hunger Games 2012 and didn't realize that film was shot almost entirely in your home state. The District 12 village where Katniss Everdeen, Peeta Mellark, and Gale Hawthorne were from was filmed in Hildebrand at an abandoned factory town. Pisgah National Forest, Shelby, Concord, Asheville, Black Mountain, and other communities supplied the background for this exciting story. Many television series were also filmed at Screen Gems in Wilmington, including Dawson's Creek, One Tree Hill, and Sleepy Hollow. Independent filmmakers also make movies in our state. Pitch a Boogie Woogie, 1947, had a local African-American cast from Greenville, including Herman Forbes, who was later named 1975's North Carolina Teacher of the Year. The film has a plot, but the fabulous local musicians and dancers are the main attraction. Here's a great blog post about the film by swing-era archivist Laura Windley at laurawindley.com/2012/07/28. Pitch-a-Boogie-Woogie-and-Whitey's-Lindy-Hoppers. North Carolina is a setting for many documentaries as well. The Staircase about a notorious murderer in Durham is currently streaming on Netflix. The Michael Peterson case has unfortunately made Durham famous the world over. My husband was at a conference in Finland and turned on the TV to see Finnish television. He was surprised to see a car driving down 147 into Durham with Finnish subtitles translating this true crime story. You too can make movies. Your smartphone is all you need to start your journey into becoming a filmmaker. Write a script or just document some family history. You can use Adobe Premiere or Final Cut to edit your film on a computer. Another great idea, enter your film about history into the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association annual contest. Starting North Carolina can also mean starring you. Here's a sidebar. See you in the movies. H. Lee Waters was a Lexington portrait photographer who took a 16mm movie camera to the streets to make movies of local people from 1936 to 1942. He would film passersby who would then pay to see themselves on the big screen of a movie theater. Did H. Lee Waters film in your community? To find out, visit the Duke University Library online at library.duke.edu/digitalcollections/hleewaters.com. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.